you up here. So one of the things, if you've been visiting here, you won't know. If you have been here, hopefully you will be remembering that this is our year where we are looking at stories. We're looking at our scriptures, our preaching series at the moment is the stories behind the door. Take a seat. But we're aware that we all come with stories, don't we? We all have a story. And Jesus is busy weaving us into his big story. And part of that is weaving us together as his body. And one of the ways that weaving us together happens is getting to know each other's story. So I'd like to introduce you to Alex this morning. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Hi, everyone. So I'm Alex. My wife and I, a short version for now, is that my wife and I have just moved to New Zealand, arriving in early to mid-January. So we've only been here a little while, and it kind of caught us by surprise in the process. So at the moment, I'm here to study counselling at Laidlaw College, which seems to be starting well enough.
Good.
And it's sort of still in some ways not entirely sure quite what we're doing here, but we are confident that somebody was very clear that we were coming to here for the right reasons and at the right time. So,
So there's been a lot of change for you this last year, it sounds like. You've changed country and you've changed profession. You're now a professional student. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds like there's a lot of learning. What's something that you have learnt about yourself?
When my wife saw that this was a question that you were inclined to ask, she laughed and went, which one or which bit? Something I've learned about myself, though, is that, and this kind of came as a surprise, is that I've been feeling now that I'm very much called to prayer as an important part of my ministry. For the first 10 years or so, I've been a Christian for about 20 years now. First 10 years or so of that, I knew prayer was kind of important, but always struggled with it. About 10 years ago, I encountered the term prayer warrior and spent the last 9.5 years going, well, I'm definitely not a prayer warrior. And as with these sorts of things, I found that by saying this often enough and saying this often enough to God, he's going, are you sure? Are you really sure?
Yeah.
So it's trying to learn what that looks like for me as well.
Yeah. What does it look like?
So prayer warrior to me is someone who is intentionally praying for the kingdom as an act of routine and as an act of intentionality on an ongoing, steady basis over a course of months, years, lifetimes. A prayer warrior in that is an absolute part of the core heartbeat of any church or any Christian organization. I'm very much a novice in this. But over the last year or so, I started to find some patterns of life that allow me to embed prayer in everything I do. I struggle to pray if I'm sat in silence.
Yeah.
But what I discovered was that if I'm moving, if I'm walking, if I'm cycling, if I'm in a state of change, I manage to tie my prayer into that. So every time I'm moving or doing something new, there's a very real chance my mind is turning to God in the process of that moment.
So maybe we need to get some exercises up the back, is that what you're saying?
Well, you'll see me moving when we're singing, certainly.
Yeah.
And if I'm fidgeting and looking at books and so on, it probably means I'm doing something to change the current. About 6 months ago, I was chatting with some people. And one of them was talking about the list of people they pray for and they've been praying for the last 20, 30, many years. And somebody else there was going, I'm not sure I'm comfortable with that. I don't know that I would be comfortable doing that, not in any way critical of the lady. And at that, I found myself going, well, obviously we're called to do this. We're called to badger the judge, to nag at him, to keep going to him, persistent in prayer. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those things of, I heard myself speaking, and that evening I started to write down a list of people I was going to start to pray for. And since then, with a couple of minor edits, as I've realised that I'm still a novice at this, I have been managing to at least pray for those people every day since. So still a bunch of learning for me, but it's definitely feeling like it is an important part of my personal ministry.
Awesome. So lots of learning, lots of things happening. If you, and it's whether you would, if you had the opportunity, would you go back to your younger self and tell yourself something? What would it be?
Yeah, I look at this question. I like my science fiction, I like my fantasy, so it's a recurring trope in that. It's the opportunity to take the time travel thing, go back and fix something and make life better. Yeah. And all too often in those sorts of stories, it doesn't work. And the thing is, I found myself looking at this question for myself, what would I change about myself? What would I change about what's gone into making me? And I've made my share of mistakes. I've hurt people. I've done things that I kind of wish I hadn't. It's definitely fair to say. But I've learned from them. And if I hadn't had those experiences, I wouldn't have learned. So it's a question that I come to and go, what would I want to let myself know to warn myself about? I wouldn't, because for all the I've caused wounds and I carry the scars of wounds that have happened to me as well, I've learned from them. It's kind of summed up in part by a song that I've got a great fondness for by Jim Croce. I think the song's title is "The Hard Way Every Time." Mm. And it's a story of life, the repeating refrain of elements like, looking back at the lessons I've learned and the mountains I wanted to climb, I just look at myself to find. I learned the hard way every time. And learned the hard way every time repeats as a line. But the final lines of the song go, but looking back at the faces I've been, I'd sure be the first one to say, when I look at myself today, I wouldn't have done it any other way.
Thank you. So. Just to finish off, what are the sorts of things that spark joy for you?
The whole thing about movement is really quite important to me, and something that I started doing quite a lot since I arrived in Christchurch, definitely helped by the fact it is so flipping flat here, is cycling. So I managed to borrow a bike on arrival and very rapidly realised that I was enjoying cycling and getting around. So the serious treat to myself since we arrived has been getting a bike of my own that is very much suited to the roads and the riding that I'm doing. So getting out on my bike, being able to see the area, get around, explore, and also, as I say, to pray at the same time. So cycling.
Wonderful. Thank you for praying for our city. Thank you for sharing some of your story with us. Yeah, thank you. And we have Susan. Not so new, Susan. As a number of times you've been here, we're not saying anything about age. Susan, would you introduce yourself and tell us how long you've been coming here?
Oh, I thought you were going to say how old I am.
No, because then someone might ask me.
My name is Susan Sapsford, and I am married to Phil, who you've probably all heard shout from the seats there. Funny story. Oh, we have four children, and I teach Ezra, who their family's not here today, but the other day I said to him at Emmanuel.
Are.
Oh, they are?
Yeah.
Oh, they are. Lovely. And I said to Ezra, did you know that Anna, who takes kids' church, is my daughter? And he was mind blown. He couldn't grasp. He was like, I said, I'm her mum. So, yeah, we're very proud of Anna and the amazing job that she's doing, and thinking of her and Adam in Zambia. We have three other children. One lives in London, one's in Glasgow, one's in Spraydon.
Mm. Yeah. And you'll get to see all of them next month in various
yes,
places.
Yes, in a few days we're heading off to the UK and just suffering for Jesus in southern Italy for a wee bit.
I finished off speaking with Alex, asking him what sparked joy for him. I'm going to start that one off for you. What sparks joy for you?
Oh, well, lots of things. Walking in a beautiful place. Phil is going to watch this, so I'll say coffee made by my handsome husband. I work at Emmanuel on a Friday and other days, and being in assembly and watching children worship, some of them have their eyes shut and their hands on their chest, and they are just lost in worship, and that is amazing to me. That makes me tear up. I love music. I love dancing at weddings. Recently did, what was it, line dancing at Matt Carter's wedding. That was fun. I love time with family. I love being creative, taking art in my teaching. Yeah.
And you are a teacher.
Yes.
But you never stop learning, do
no.
you, throughout life?
Yeah.
What's something that you've learned about yourself this year?
Two things. One is that with the theme of joy, I am learning to look for the joy in the mundane days. You know, there's big things like going on an overseas trip, you know, birthdays, weddings, that kind of thing. But just looking for the wonder in each day. I'm trying to learn to be more present, take time out with the Lord and just sit and, yeah, enjoy the little things and find joy in those, because there are lots of mundane days in our lives. And that, yeah, to watch and see the goodness of God. I was thinking too that even in the worst of situations, there is an opportunity to know joy. I do remember well when I was 29, my first husband died, and there were lots and lots of tears. But I remember my dad saying, "How can you laugh about anything, Susan?" But it felt, you know, lots of you all know this, when you feel such a deep sadness, to feel joy and to know laughter feels so, so good and so rich. And then, did you ask me about what I've learned? I've been learning lots in the last year. One of the big learnings, which I'm a slow learner, is that we can choose what we think about. And I have been a chronic worrier at times. 10 or 11 years ago, my sister and I went on a trip to the UK, and looking back on that, that was just like shrouded in anxiety, really. And this time, for me, I just am so thankful, because the Lord's been teaching me how to choose. I can choose my thoughts, and as it says in the Bible, whatever is true, noble, just, pure, lovely, and of good report, meditate on these things. So, I am a late learner, but I feel like I'm really learning to choose my thoughts, practice those thoughts, and see the wonder of that. And then the other thing that I've learned about myself in the past year is delight, that God delights in us. And I'm learning to delight in him more. And just quickly, one of those things has been, over the years, when I've needed to pray about something big, often I've gone for a walk on the beach and just sense God's presence there so much. And, you know, sometimes the walks have meant tears, really chewing over something that I'm finding hard or something that I know someone else is finding hard. But last year, last winter, I was walking along the beach and I just sort of, it wasn't even really like a prayer. I just had this thought with God, I'd love to live out here one day. And I felt the Lord say really clearly to me, you will, and the timeline might surprise you. And long story short, it's been a delightful journey to see that come about. And 3 weeks ago, we moved out to the beach. And we can see the sunrise from our bedroom, and we can go barefoot down the path over the sand dunes and have a swim. And for Phil and I found our kids, two of our kids moving overseas. I really mourned it. I found it really hard. But at the same time, this wonderful adventure began of us planning to move out there. And we feel like God's, we're on an adventure together, like for our marriage. I think it's really been wonderful. So knowing that God delights in us and he delights in answering the desires of our hearts.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Susan. It can be really hard to share some of our stories up here, but it can also be really speak to others. So I've had lots of really good comments from people as you are hearing some of other people's stories. So we will keep these going. Now, you're mine for the next hour. Not quite. It's Trevor says, I'm going to give you 5 more minutes. Well done for everybody getting here this morning. You all got up out of bed, but it's getting darker in the mornings, isn't it? My dog, Chica, sleeps in the room with us. She's got a little bed by the side, and she normally sees the first hint of dawn. She sees that first lot of sun rays coming up, and she just gives us a little woof. Just this gentle little woof, thankfully by Adam's ear, usually, which says, hey, it's time to get up. And usually we put her, until 6 a.m, and then we let her out. But she's been sleeping in until about 7 a.m. lately. So I've been waking up naturally without my wolf alarm. But yes, public service announcements from Rob and from me up here. We're going to mess with the clocks next weekend, aren't we? Who prefers the darker mornings? Show of hand, who prefers darker mornings? Who prefers the darker evenings? There's a little bit of a mix. There's something about darkness that changes things, isn't there? If we're out and it starts to get dark, it gives us an urge to go inside. And if we're inside and we need to go out, but it's still dark out, it brings a hesitation. We don't really want to start venturing out until it starts to get a bit lighter. We're a little bit reluctant to go out these dark mornings. But here at the core, this is the central saying, one of the last 7 things that we are looking at in our series that Jesus said before he died. We're at number 4, so we're at the central one. And Luke tells us it was now the 6th hour, and darkness came over the whole land until the 9th hour. So we're looking about noon to 3 o'clock, for the sun stopped shining. So Jesus is on the cross, and those early crowds that were there had started to disperse. And a long time of waiting for death had begun. Because death on the cross took a long time. That was the point of it. and a darkness had descended. It was an unnatural darkness. It lasted about 3 hours, we're told. And I know we're pretty prone these days to look at anything like this and to start to want to immediately explain it in scientific terms, don't we? Anything that happened biblically, we want to have this scientific explanation. We kind of think that these ancient people weren't sophisticated people. And it's true that they didn't quite have the same technology we did. I love watching archaeology shows. And I haven't seen anybody dig up a six-cylinder chariot lately. But they knew about eclipses. And it seems that there was an eclipse. I wasn't there. I am old, Sam, but I'm not this old. There was apparently an eclipse in AD 29, so just a few years before the crucifixion, November 24, AD 29, so they say. I wasn't there. But this was no natural event. Throughout Jerusalem, there would have been a darkness felt. And I can only imagine what it must have felt like. Heavy. Foreboding. But what was the significance of it? There could be many, many reasons. Luke tells us that when Jesus spoke to those who had come to arrest him, he spoke the words, "But this is your hour when darkness reigns." We're really ahead. There we go. That one makes more sense, doesn't it? It might have been the fulfillment of prophecy, because Joel tells of a time when the sun will be turned to darkness and the moon to blood before that great and dreadful day of the Lord. And the prophet Amos as well wrote, "In that day, declares the sovereign Lord, I will make the sun go down at noon and darken the earth in broad daylight. I will turn your religious feasts into mourning and all your singing into weeping. I will make all of you wear sackcloth and shave your heads, and I will make that time like mourning for an only son, and the end of it like a bitter day." It might have been a way for the Godhead to convey what was happening to the people in the cultural understanding of their time, much like God still reveals to us things that are important to us that we understand within our culture. We have writings from people like Philo, who is writing in the first century AD. He's a Jewish writer. And one of the things that we have of him was his explanation of what people thought eclipses were, the darkness that arrived. They were indications either of the impending death of some king or of the destruction of some city. Or it could have been the signal of a father's anger at how his only begotten son is being treated. Isaiah writes, "The rising sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light. I'll punish the world for its evil, the wicked for its sins. I'll put an end to the arrogance of the haughty and will humble the pride of the ruthless." Or it could have been the physical manifestation of the Father's judgment. The sins of the world being borne upon Christ's shoulders as he hung on the cross. So the Lamb of God was bearing upon himself the very sins of the world. And now in deep, deep torment, Jesus cries out in a loud voice. And Mark uses the verb there, bow, to describe this cry. It's to use one's voice at high volume, to call, to shout, to cry out. And we find that the biblical authors can use it to describe kind of some of the excited cries from crowds. But more usually, they use it for pleading, anguish. We find it being used of the man begging Jesus to heal his son. We hear this cry in the blind man who is begging Jesus, "Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me." And we find this cry in Acts. The shrieks of the people as evil spirits are leaving them. "Eloi, Eloi, sabachthani," which means, "God, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And this is one of the only times that we find Jesus addressing God in this way. In his other recorded prayers, he uses terms that we would more ascribe to as Father. There's a closeness. You know, one of the ways that we can identify what sin is by looking at the effects that it has of relationship, isn't it? Sin is something that breaks relationship. It breaks relationship between myself and God, between myself and other people, between myself and myself, between myself and creation that we have been commanded to look after. You know, the Ten Commandments are not some arbitrary set of rules that God just decided one day these sounded good. The things that Jesus spoke out against are not just some whim, but they are the things which break relationship. If you're wondering if what you're doing, and it's not recorded in the Bible, is sinful, have a really good effect. Look, really good look at the effect it's having on your relationships. Here in the deep work that Jesus is doing on the cross, he's taking the sins of the world, those sins that have already been committed at this time, but also the sins of us here today. The ones that we've already committed and the ones that we're going to go on to commit when we leave here. All of them were taken upon his shoulders. And here in his hour of desperation, he addresses God as would any other person. "My God, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And he can do this because he hasn't lost faith. It's not because he has lost faith. In fact, just the fact that he is praying, "My God," shows that there is still a trust. But the intimacy of fellowship seems to have been broken. That relationship has been broken, and Jesus no longer feels the presence of his Father. You know, forsaken's a really hard thing to think of when we think about God, isn't it? We're so steeped in Scripture, which says, "I will never leave you or forsake you. Even though you are faithless, I will be faithful." But clearly Jesus here senses he's utterly forsaken by God. And so he leans into what I hope a lot of us do here when we're in times of real hardship. We lean into Scripture. And he leaned into Psalm 22. My God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me? So far from the words of my groaning?" And there's been so much study, so much speculation on what on earth could be happening here. God made him who had no sin to be sin for us, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. You know, Jesus is forsaken by God as he takes our sins upon himself. He's the Lamb of God who has taken away the sins of the world. Atoning for our sin is the ultimate Passover lamb, a sacrifice made on behalf of the whole world. And Jesus' agonizing cry gives us a glimpse of the cost of our forgiveness, because it wasn't free. Neither for the Father or the Son. It wrenched them apart, put them on opposite sides, if only for that little time. And Jesus' agonizing teaches us something about how much the Father and the Son's love for us was, that they were willing to sever their bond, even for a time. Here in the darkness, we see the deep, deep mystery of the fatherlessness of the Son and of the sonlessness of the Father. In the first saying that we looked at in this series, probably because I've spent the, you know, who's here ever seen fishermen casting out their hand nets? I've spent the last 25 years kind of watching people, you're nodding, people in the Mekong, casting out their nets. And in this first saying, you see Jesus casting his net, a wide circle, giving forgiveness to all. People into the future, us and our future generations. And then in the second saying, truly I say to you, he's casting his net, but it's a slightly smaller circle. He's saying, for those who will come into relationship with me, you will have relationship with me in paradise. Still a wide circle, but not quite as wide as the first. And then we had Pamela preaching last week. And you'll see the door out there with the light shining through it, where Jesus is saying, woman, here is your son. Here is your mother. That circle is becoming a little bit closer, isn't it? But speaking of us, as we are brought into this new relationship as part of his church, being interwoven as family in a new way. But here today, at this saying, we have a really small circle being cast. Because there's something about pain which is isolating, isn't it? If you've ever been in deep, deep pain, whether physical pain or emotional pain or spiritual pain, you might have the comfort of people with you, but there's profound loneliness and deep pain. And here Jesus speaks of himself and of his relationship to his Father. And it's in this cry, the cry of one ravished with physical pain. Pain so intense that even to rise himself up to get a breath. He's had the emotional agony of seeing those in front of him shattered by what he's going through. and of those not before him, having scattered in their fear. And now he's facing the relational agony of losing the connection between the beloved and the Father. It's this loss of connection, this break of relationship that sin begets. But in this case, no sin of his own. It was my sin. It was your sin. It was our sin. Because he who knew no sin became sin for us. So what really happened on those dreadful hours on the cross, when it was dark? I think Jesus faced the pain of being so alone that we might never be alone again. Because of that work that he did during this time, we can know that when we take on the mantle of being one of the beloved of God, it will not be taken from us. But how did the crowd respond to Jesus' words? Can you remember what they did? Some of them responded in mocking rejection. Some of them thought he was calling Elijah. Maybe with the call for Eloi, thinking he was calling Elijah. Because the Jewish thought at that time in the first century was that Elijah would come in the last days and help those who were righteous. One of them ran and they got a sponge of wine vinegar out of mercy. No mercy. The wine had myrrh, a drug used to dull pain, to prolong the agony of death. You know, in this situation, I look on and I think, the same as I do with lots of historical things and where history is being made in the world today, I look on and I think, man, how could people just stand and look on? How can people be so cruel? But then I think, but what would I have done? How would I have been different? Jesus experienced in this time the utter awfulness of sin. And we talk very easily and glibly about our sin, don't we? We are sinners, but we are forgiven. So to some extent we can. But some of us are struggling with big sins, those of which would make all of us open our eyes a little wider and go, yep, that'll do it. But all of us here do things like say, well, I don't steal, and yet will happily buy really cheap goods from sweatshops, robbing people of the chance to live lives such as we enjoy. We all say we do not lie, and yet when I open up my social media account or I go onto YouTube, I'll click the one with the most sensational headline, even though I know that at its very, very best, it's just a distortion of the truth. We all say we love God above all else, and yet we avert our gaze as he's pricking our conscience about the need that's just outside our door. All of those things break relationship. All of those things are sin. They broke relationship 2,000 years ago on a hillside in a time of very eerie darkness. At some point. Can we go to the next slide, Dave? Thank you. That's the most nice picture of a sunny hillside I could find. Because once on a sunny hillside, Jesus taught his disciples to pray. And he taught them to pray, "Our Father, who is in heaven, holy be your name." But once, on a very dark hillside, Jesus taught us that we can pray, "Oh Lord, why have you forsaken me?" And in his pain, he has cast us the most incredible hope. Because of his sacrifice there, we will never be cut off from God, from his mercy, from his love, because it's paid. There's something very significant about darkness. Not just the reluctance for us leaving our house in the morning or wanting to get back to our house at night. It's in the darkness that we most need to know of Christ's love for us. And it was in this moment of darkness that he showed it. If I can have the music team up, please.
So